Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for a discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its webpages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
NVB. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody on the net. Good to be here this evening. Back to net.
Okay, very good, Bob. I don't know if you heard a little earlier, but I'm doing this thankfully direct. My antenna, which was having problems with my neighbor's weed tree, apparently the fall has caused the leaves to drop have impacted upon its ability and improved it for the time being. So I'm operating direct. Good to hear you, Bob. So let us begin with the technical net. If anyone has any questions or topics that they would like to discuss or comments they would like to make, give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2GS. N4ESU, Glenn in Bay Ridge with a question slash comment.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, perhaps some people will come by at a later time. Glenn, what's your question for tonight?
I was eavesdropping on the beginning of the Limar computer net a few minutes ago, and they mentioned that you had sent in some feedback on the 20H2 version of Windows 10, and I'm running it on two machines, and I haven't had the problem that you described with the Windows not returning to full screen. So I was wondering if you got any resolution and are there any other issues that you found?
Well, yeah, I mean, as we speak right now, I am recording on my computer, the computer net, because I like to send Ken comments. He frequents the Limark technical net on Sunday nights. So I like to have a hand in his net as well. I only had it on for about 8 hours because I couldn't figure out how to get around that very idiosyncratic problem, which for me was once you minimize the window, you couldn't restore it back. The taskbar would not register it as hidden in it. You know, usually there's that little blue bar underneath. That wasn't visible, and I could not for the life of me figure out any way to get it restored back to the screen. I had to kill the task and run it again. I looked if Microsoft had a fix for any of that. I couldn't find anything. I even went to my video card manufacturer, NVIDIA, to see if there was a new update. There was none. I even did a Google search, and surprisingly, I guess, I didn't see anyone else complaining. So it might be some very idiosyncratic reaction to my video card and driver. But because I couldn't find a newer driver and I didn't want to screw around with uninstalling the present state-of-the-art driver and trying previous generations, I figured it was a lot easier to just remove 20H2 for the time being. And I'm sure someone will figure it out and either solve it and post it, or Microsoft themselves will fix the problem. That was the only problem I had with it. I didn't really see any additional features. I didn't look into it too deeply. But that problem with minimizing Windows for about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, I thought of just living with it. And then I said, nah.
It's very interesting how quirky these machines can react to the changes in the software. All right, great. I was just wondering if you had any other issues with it, because I run it like I said. I have it on two machines. One is a gaming machine I use for my flight simulator, and so I was wondering if there were any other issues that you had. Thank you.
No problem. That's the problem that Windows has, in that since they don't set the hardware protocols, the specifications, beyond a certain point, like AMD or Intel chipsets and such, there are so many varied devices, and it's pretty much impossible to beta test every configuration. Usually, I'm a little bit more conservative. I usually don't jump on to a update, and I have three computers at home, and I had no idea of upgrading the other two until I tested it out on my desktop. This is the one I tested it up on is an i9. It's my Shack desktop. It's Mission Control. If you ever go to my QRZ page, so it's a very important computer to me of my three. But I'm sure they'll get to it. I'm every so often Googling to see if anyone realizes it's a problem. So far, I haven't found anything, but it's a curiosity.
I wonder if you downloaded it on one of your other machines just to see if it has the same glitch in it, you know?
Well, it's very possible that it won't affect them. The other two are Lenovo's. One's a glorified tablet. The other is a laptop. But, once burned, twice cautious. I figured I would just give it a little bit more time to, like good wine. You have to age some operating systems.
Roger that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Glenn. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am Net Control Operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any technical questions or even scientific questions or what have you, you can throw it out there, and if I can't answer it, maybe someone listening in can. So please give me your first name and your call sign if you have either questions or topics you'd like to hear discussed or comments that you'd like to make.
NBB. If no one else has got anything at the moment, I've got some COVID and flu shot questions.
Okay, let them rip, Bob.
Okay, I'll start with the flu shot. This was kind of interesting. I just called a clinic, and I was calling about some other things. Actually, maybe we should start with the COVID thing, because that would dovetail into this. I was feeling kind of run down yesterday, a little sick, and I actually got a COVID test. I actually got two, the rapid and the regular PCR, and both ended up being negative. but I was calling and inquiring about that. And I, but, oh, one thing was interesting. I wanted to get an antibody test because I, you might remember, I thought I might have had COVID back in May. And I still think I might have had a mild case of COVID back in May. It turns out I asked them for an antibody test, and then I found out something you already know, I'm sure, that now they know there are no antibodies after 3 months, and there's no way you can, she said, that currently there's no way you can test for having had COVID more than 3 months ago. First of all, I guess you would concur with that. I think my own doctor concurred on that. But I wonder if there would ever be a possibility of testing something like T cells so they could tell ahead of time, and maybe, I guess they're still learning whether people are still immune after the antibodies leave, et cetera, et cetera. So your thoughts on all that. I got more after that, but start you with that.
Okay, that sounds more like a COVID question than a flu question. As you mentioned, unfortunately, it seems that the antibodies that at least are presently being used as a detection method tend to diminish over 3 to 4 months after an infection. The hope, belief, what have you, is that other immune systems that don't operate on antibodies but operate on sensitizing killer T cells and such take over most of the function that the antibodies temporarily do. I do not believe there is any kind of test for T cell sensitization for HIV. That would probably not be a very simple test to do. And I'm not aware if researchers are expending their energies in that avenue. I'm sure some are. Is it theoretically possible? Yes. Is it easy? It's certainly a heck of a lot harder than just to do regular antibody, to demonstrate the titers of antibodies. But, you know, that's the problem there. That's one of the problems with the question of what kind of immunity do you have? If you become infected, are you spared this infection for the rest of your life, for the next 10 years, for the next 1 year, for the next 4 months? And no one's quite sure. There are, unfortunately, a few cases that are very well documented of people who had COVID and then became reinfected by a different strain about 3-4 months later. Although probably it's not as likely to happen, it's not a guarantee that it won't happen. How that reflects on the present vaccinations being tested is really problematic because no one has the time to give these vaccines a chance after 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months. They want to get them out the door.
Yeah, I hear you on that. So they don't really know for sure whether a vaccine would only work for a short time or what have you, even if it seems to work when they're initially testing it. The other thing is, this kind of, I've had this thing where I feel like I'm coming down with something. You know, in the last few months, it'll come on, something only lasts a few hours, then it goes away. But last week it was like several days. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just imagining, but it's a little different than when I used to get sometimes that with a cold. That feeling of sort of like a fever coming on, but no actual fever, would last that long. And I'm wondering. I guess no one knows. It's a speculation, and could be one of many possibilities. And they could, well, if I had a mild case of COVID, maybe these are sort of these residual symptoms coming back. Report having these residual symptoms of COVID, so I guess that's a possibility too for that.
Well, again, there's a lot of questions. You have to realize we've only had this novel virus for a little over 9 months. You want to count China, We're still figuring out a whole bunch of things. I just read a very pessimistic report that suggests that people's cognitive abilities have been demonstrated, that some people don't think as well as they used to after an infection from this virus. It's going to lead a bunch of people with underlying problems. They could have subclinical pneumonitis, and that could lead to pulmonary problems as they get older. It attacks kidney function, so it can undermine kidney function as the person gets older. And there are some neurological deficits, one of them being the cognitive function. So we don't really know all that it's going to do to us, and even after the infection. And I think part of this, unfortunately, is the obvious stress of the situation. If you're distracted and there's no talk of pandemics and people dying and you have an ache and a pain or a little bit of a feverish feeling, you put it away in your mind and you go about your business. If you read and hear all about what's going on, you think twice, if not three times. There's an entire disease called fibromyalgia, which has no diagnostic indicators. You can't test for it. It's people feeling kind of tired and achy. It responds to antidepressants, but if you suggest that it's a psychological disorder, everyone gets angry at you. And there are other things like that. So it's kind of difficult to separate the stress that we're all under from this new normalcy, from other causes for these symptoms.
Yeah, I hear you. I didn't expect you to have a definite answer to that. Just thought I'd bounce it off of you. Yeah, I think the same kind of thing. Those are all possible things. Yeah, every time you feel a little something coming on, you go, oh, no. This COVID. One more concrete question. I was now to the flu shot. I thought it'd be better to, when I was calling about that other stuff, I said, well, by the way, you know, can I just come in for a flu shot, you know, waiting in line? And this one clinic happened to say, well, we only have the ones for people over 65 right now. And I said, well, I'm 5 months, or actually a little more than 4 months shy of 65. And they're saying, oh, we can't give it to you. And I asked, what's the difference? They said they'll get those in the other kind in November, which is probably soon. But what's the difference between the one that they give to people over 65 and the one people under 65? And I'm wondering which one I should be getting. I mean, I guess I should be getting the one for people over 65.
Yeah, I think that would be wise on your part. The over 65 type is just more of the same. It's a more concentrate, a more powerful shot, with the understanding that as we get older, our immune mechanisms need a little bit more sturdier kick in the keister than younger people. So it's nothing that different. It's just a little bit more of the same, if you will.
So obviously that's true, but this place wouldn't give it to me because they probably have some like hard rule about it. And I really don't want to wait till March. I'll just try another clinic and hope it's a policy thing that varies. Also, I'm wondering what would happen if a younger person got the stronger one. I mean, is a stronger one a risk of having a side effect and making you feel sick more than the other one?
AC2GS. Well, in answer to the first thing, I think it's probably more of a billing situation for them, that if they're going to bill insurance companies, the companies probably don't want to pay the premium, so they lock down that, because they know exactly how old we are, that if you're under 65, they could get away with a cheaper shot, and so they're not going to pay anything extra. So that's probably why that medical facility told you that. There is a slightly, as you increase the concentration, you also increase the possibility of people having immune responses that you don't want them to have. I'm sure you've talked to people, or you might have noticed There's a little bit of an achiness, and some people can have even low-grade fevers because, like I said before, you're kicking your immune system in the keister, and it usually sends out signals all over the place and very often overreacts a little bit.
Right, you would think that maybe that would be, well, maybe they figure older people, they're not going to kick it, it's not going to be reacting as much because it's older. And, yeah, I remember when I was a kid, my mother saying, I got a flu shot, makes you sick. I guess she had one experience, but that was, you know, 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago. And the technology may have changed since then. And so I may be forced to get the weaker shot just because that's all they'll give me. So I guess I'll do that rather than nothing if it comes to that.
Yeah, I mean, if there's that much of a gap in time, you're better off with the non-over 65 than nothing. It was probably a little bit too early. They kind of became overly aggressive, and they started to distribute it in late August and early September. But these things also have a limited time span. If you take it in August, it's very possible that the tail end of the flu season in March is gonna kick you. So these things are not perfect, unfortunately. I wish they were. They have a limited lifespan of usefulness. It doesn't stop at one time. It just kind of fades away slowly. And it only covers for a select group of influenza viruses, which are usually the best guess that the infectious disease and CDC and such have come up with the previous spring. So some years it's more effective than other years. But all things being equal, we got bad enough problems with COVID-19. We're going to see another big bump. It's going up in the numbers. It's going to be followed by an increase in hospitalization. And unfortunately, most likely, it's going to be followed in an increase in mortality. So the last thing anyone wants is to have to deal with both influenza infections and COVID-19 infections simultaneously.
Right. Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, it sounds like this might be a good time to get a flu shot because it's, you know, it's closer to March than August was. And I've only had one flu shot in my entire life. That was 2 years ago. And I had no reaction to it. So, I don't know. And I haven't had the flu in, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 years, something like that, that I know of. So, yeah. So I'll get one, and because for no other reason, I don't want to have get sick with the flu or anything else, and have to go through that psychological torment of thinking I might have COVID. Just the psychology of that is enough to make me prevent it. All right, back to you, Roy. I think that's all I got for the moment on that.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. We start this at 9 p.m. and we go on until people run out of questions or comments to make. We also have a puzzle that's on our website. You can type in puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that'll take you to our puzzle page. The puzzle is a relatively simple one. It's all in text, so you don't have to look at pictures. And I'll just recite it now and ask if anyone has any other questions or topics before we get to the puzzle. But the puzzle, basically, the premise is on 80 meters, the DX comes in at night. Why is this? And your choice for answers is A, local interference is at a minimum, B, signals are not absorbed by the D layer, C, noise level on the band is less, and D, the air temperature is lower. So keep those all in mind. We'll get to that again. But if anyone has any other questions or topics for tonight's Technical Net, please let me know.
KD2MLY.
Yes, Joe.
Net control, KD2MLY.
Yes, KD2MLY. Go ahead.
Good evening, Roy, and good evening to those on the net. So, you know, I came across
a question that actually someone else asked, and when I remember studying for one of the exams, it stayed in my mind for a short moment, and then I forgot about it, and then it came up after I saw it on the internet. I saw a question that was asked, and it was answered, but it still wasn't clear. And it's regarding the 630 meter and 220 meter band.
Yes.
Okay. Let me see if I still have this. Okay, so the 630 and the 2200 meter band. That's what it is. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's a question on the extra exam. And I think it's a new question, actually, if I'm not mistaken. But my question is, it doesn't appear that these two bands are easily accessible. Why is that? And it also doesn't appear that most rigs are able to pull these bands up and hams being able to have a conversation on them as they would on any other band. I know it was suggested that these bands are mainly used for experiments, and if that's the case, I was just wondering what type of experiments and why is it that the UTC has to be notified before a ham, an amateur radio operator, can transmit on these bands. Back to net control.
Okay. These bands are very low frequency. They previously were used, I believe, by the Navy to communicate with submarines. They have a very low bit symbol rate, which means you can't transfer as much information in the very low frequencies as you can in the higher frequencies. Also, they have limited the power output to a lot of those. I think the EIRP for the 630 is 5 watts. That's not going to really do much. The total power is much higher. It's something like 500 watts peak envelope power. But the problem is that it's so difficult to radiate these things, because think in terms of usually you're using a resonant standing wave antenna, which means that at the very smallest, mechanically, it's a quarter of a wavelength. If you were to make up a quarter of a wavelength of a 630-meter antenna, you would run out of real estate rather quickly. So there are a lot of low-efficiency designs that end up being used. So because of the low efficiency of the antenna design and such, and because that it's still considered experimental, it's not a well-used frequency except for the Navy. So they put kind of limiters of all kinds. So for the most part, and it's kind of amusing to me, they call themselves loafers, which is very close to my last name, Laufer. But they're loafers. They're experimentalists who spend a lot of time and trouble trying to build relatively efficient antennas for these modes, which is very, very difficult.
Okay, I see. Roy, I always know you. We out here in the radio world always know we can count on you for clarification. Thank you so much for that, Roy. I was just thought it interesting and wondered how useful those bands were to ham radio operators. Again, thank you. This is Kilo Delta 2, Mike Leo Yankee. Back to net control. Oh, and I have. A guess, sort of. Well, not so much a guess. To an answer to the question, to the TechNet puzzle.
Okay, very good, Joe. Stay tuned. Most likely, we'll get to it very, very soon. You know, low frequency is kind of the bleeding edge of amateur radio. It's interesting that microwave is the other end of the spectrum, and that also is bleeding edge. There's still a lot of very bright guys who build their own equipment, and usually because microwave is a different animal entirely, that's a truly line of sight communication. A lot of times they'll get their dish antennas out and climb up to either a very high hill or a reasonably sized mountain and communicate mountaintop to mountaintop. And those guys are experimentalists, and so are the loafers experimentalists. It's a very limited thing, which is why probably the Navy gave it back to us. They have pretty much figured out how to use other frequencies with much higher symbol rates than the very low frequencies that it once used, especially for submarine communications. But thank you, Joe, for your question. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that's here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. So if anyone else has any questions or topics or comments, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I think someone keyed up the repeater, but I didn't hear any audio. So if you tried to get through, try again, please.
Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor, William here.
Hello, William. How are you tonight? Do you have a question or a topic?
Right, really, I'm just listening in. I noticed that when I'm transmitting, it kills my FM radio receiver, but I think it must just be overloading the front end.
Yes, you experience what generally is called desensing. By just pouring a lot of off-frequency RF onto the front end of that receiving radio, you're diminishing its functional gain.
I thought that was definitely the case. Have you done the TechNet question yet?
No, I haven't done it yet. We're going to do it, I guess, very, very soon. I've been reading up on Euler's constant, Euler's number, by the way. Matter of fact, I had a very interesting email from a gentleman on my other technical net, on the Limark technical net. He found it amusing that and one of the things that you see when you look up Euler's constant is that it uses the imaginary number I, or what electrical engineers use as J, a lot in the equations. So he sent me email that he thought it was rather interesting that J, the imaginary number electrical engineers use, if you take an imaginary number like J and you raise it to J's power, the answer is not an imaginary number. The number is a real number. And the way that you calculate the result is by using Euler's constant, because you can use I with Euler's constant very easily. E to the pi I is equal to minus 1. So that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of Euler's constant in complex numbers used by electrical engineers.
I think that's really amazing, and so it's just also a lot of fractal sets, you know, start going in the I direction, and that's what creates some of those designs and stuff like that too. So the I thing is very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate personally to me that it kind of broke in half when the electrical engineers decided to use complex numbers in a lot of its math, because it just made things incredibly easy. They decided that there were too many things that were labeled I in electrical engineering, so they decided to change it to J. I still do the translation in my head, because the first time I learned about imaginary numbers, I learned them as I.
Maybe electrical engineering, we use J omega, you know, for the spinning vector.
Well, yeah, but it's the same with mathematics, except in I. When I mentioned that e to the pi I, it's basically a pi is the value of omega. So even the standard math of Euler's number is e to the minus ir. Phi. So that angle is there even for regular classical mathematics. It's just that, I don't know, I think it's a little messy that when you jump from classical math to electrical engineering, the I turns into a J.
Then if you have to deal with three dimensions, then you have IJK, and kind of like it gets back to making sense again.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting numbers. I is a scalar value. You can have matrix values that are imaginary or that are complex. Mathematics is intriguing. Almost every really useful mathematical theorem started out as theoretical without any consideration of what you could apply it to. And it's only been after the fact that very bright engineers and physicists and other scientists have found these classical theoretical mathematical constructs and applied them to real world things like fractals and such.
One number is I.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Mathematics Museum of Math, MOM, and they do a weekly puzzler in which they just throw the most abstract problem ever out, and, you know, it usually has an arcane answer and it's very annoying, but it also is quite a lot to try to think about during the week.
Yes, indeed. If you at all like YouTube, there are so many great channels on YouTube that only discuss mathematics. Sometimes they try to use it, explain it without showing equations, which is very difficult. Sometimes they do equations. Others try to do three-dimensional representations of what's going on. It's all incredibly fascinating. You could drop down a rabbit hole rather quickly and easily. There was someone in the background who was mentioning the number pi. Do you have a comment to make? Okay, I guess not. So once again, anyone with any questions or topics tonight for the Technical Net? Okay, very well. We'll go to the puzzle then. So the question is, on 80 meters, the DX comes in at night. And the question is, why is this? Your choices for the answer is A, local interference is at a minimum. B, signals are not absorbed by the D layer. C, noise levels on the band are less. And D, the air temperature is lower. So if anyone would like to take a chance, please tell me what you think the answer is.
82 MLY.
Yes, Joe.
I'd say the answer is, I tell you, if it had an all of the above, I may have chosen that, but I would say the answer is B, signals are not absorbed by the D layer.
Okay. Anyone with any other choices that they'd like to make?
Charlie 2 Zulu Victor.
Yes, William.
Think about that all of above choice and whether or not the temperature really has anything possibly to do with it. I know that, you know, the night could have less noise and stuff like that, and the D layer is probably what's going on, but is there anything to do with temperature?
No, I don't think you could make any particular case that temperature directly is an issue. You can infer that it's warmer than in the daytime when the sun is out, than the night when the sun isn't out, and that the sun is having an effect, and then draw some weird conclusion correlation does not mean causation. So it's very common for the signal to go bad when the temperature goes up, because most of the time that's when the sun is out.
The whole difference would be the whole KGB in the wire, but I don't think the difference in T would make that much difference in the absolute noise level.
Yeah, in cases of lava getting onto your antenna, you probably have more problems than just the random heat generated by the high kinetic energy of the wire.
Like Joe wins.
Yes, indeed. Joe is quite right. Signals are not absorbed by the D layer. Now, sometimes people get the ionosphere a little bit confused. Because they're told that the reason why 20 kind of lights up during the day and during sunspot cycles especially, 10 and 6 meters becomes magic bands. And that's because you're energizing the E and the F, sometimes the F1 and F2 ionospheric layer, and that usually is beneficial. Signals will refract through an ionized layer and bend and reflect back onto the Earth, and sometimes it'll bounce off the Earth back into the ionosphere and make multiple jumps across the globe. So that benefits propagation. The problem is 80 and 40 doesn't quite work that way. It's very sensitive to the D layer, which is destructive for 80 and 160. So when the sun comes out and the D layer energizes, what happens is instead of the 80 and 160 meters going through a rather pale version of the D layer onto the E and the F and bounce off of it, it's kind of absorbed. And also noise is kind of reflected back. So the D layer energizing is not beneficial to us hams. That's why at night and towards the winter time, 80 and 160 propagation tends to be better, and sunspot minimums, they tend to be a little bit better. But we all pine still for the sunspot maximum, because, you know, we could suffer the slight degradation at night for the amazing magic bands of 10 and 6 when the sunspot cycle is high. So the answer, yes, indeed, is answer B, signals are not absorbed by the D layer. Gold star to Joe.
Question?
Yes, Joe.
So out of the E and F layer, is the 80-meter band bounced back to Earth via both of them, or one of them, and if it's both, which one has a better effect?
Science is surprisingly very vague about this. You won't get a clear answer no matter where, because I've looked. Either they don't bother to explain that refraction takes place, although obviously refraction does. If you ponder the possibility that DX on 80 meters is a ground wave propagation situation, it'll just give you a migraine because it doesn't work. I have kind of seen hints at both. I have not seen any very good tests that demonstrate whether this is true or not. Apparently, a very, very vague, slight E ionosphere that's just almost not energized is sufficient to refract it back down. So probably most of it is a very weak E.
So then, I guess 80 meters even in the evening is not ideal for DX.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you call DX. For the most part, a lot of activity goes on 80 meters across the country. Regularly, nightly, when I used to actually have an antenna, you could hear people down in Florida. You could hear people up in Massachusetts and New England all the time. You could hear people in the Midwest. You get much farther these days on 80 and 160. If you have a semi-decent antenna, then you're going to get, for the most part, on 20 and certainly 10 and 6.
Okay, thanks, Roy. KD2MLY, back to net control. Thank you.
What's a semi-decent antenna?
Everything is a compromise. So if you have a half wave dipole, if you have a reasonably long end fed with some impedance matching of some kind, that might be enough. The problem is guys who try and get by with a ham stick. Ham sticks are not very efficient, and as you increase the bandwidth for the ham stick, it becomes very inefficient. So there are people who have ham sticks for mobile ham sticks for their car with a whip that isn't that terribly long, but they make it up with a loaded inductor at the base. And I've seen studies that demonstrate that the efficiency for that type of antenna for 80 meters can be as low as 1 to 2%.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to spend much money, but I think I could probably come up with a really long wire. But it seems like I just get a bunch of grinding noise. I don't really get too many stations out of that. What is the thing? How do I get an impedance matching thing that would go, I guess, between that long wire and the antenna input on the radio?
Theoretically, you can design your own. There are calculations that you could make on websites, but most people get antenna tuners. Antenna tuners are simply impedance matching circuits. Some are L-based, some are T-based, some are pi-based, but they all do impedance matching to one degree or another. Some have much better range. They can adjust for wider impedances than others. If you're going to use an antenna tuner, theoretically, it's best to either use very low-loss transmission line to the antenna tuner or just stick the antenna tuner in a weatherproof enclosed box at the site of the antenna itself. But that's what we all use to match impedances these days. It does introduce an additional loss. In a perfect world, we would have perfectly resonant antennas.
Does the tuner have lightning protection built into it?
I'm sure some do. Most don't. Smart people tend to put their own out there just to be on the safe side. There are different companies that sell little spark gap grounding devices. You always have to be cautious if you're going to put the antennas up high. The problem generally in the New York area is that most people don't put anything too high, which is probably why you're getting more local noise. You have a lot of electrical noise in urban environments, and the closer to ground you have, the less efficient and the more ground propagated local noise you're going to pick up.
You can put like a long wire out the front of the building, over the roof, and then down the backside. You know, and that would be, I guess the building's like 100 feet long, so it'd be like 120 feet wire I could probably spool out, but it wouldn't be stood off from the building by much. It would just be sitting on the roof. Would that work?
Well, it depends upon what's underneath the roof. If the roof is made of non-conducting material and there aren't too many wires nearby, it might not impact your situation. If there's a whole bunch of conduits and ducts and such just underneath, it can perturb the benefit of the wire. You know, everything we do tends to be a compromise of one degree or another. You might not get, 75% efficiency. You might get 52, but 52 is certainly better than zero.
Okay, that sounds good. I guess we'll play around with that soon this winter when it's a nice day. And I have somebody to help me play with the wire a little bit. The ground seems to be very important also, to be able to have a good ground connection. I'm thinking that the water pipe would be the right place to go up in a third floor apartment. What do you think?
Generally speaking, if you're going to look for a ground that's in a house, cold water is the best. You have to make sure that no one's played around and put plex plastic inserts between the metal pipes, but otherwise, that's the best. Some people have to use their hot water pipes. That can be problematic on a bunch of levels. Under no circumstances, as I repeatedly suggest, people should never use their outlet ground as their RF ground, because the electrical utility ground is not a definite thing. It really depends on what leg it's attached to, what devices are attached to that leg, and it could be somewhat live. So I would dissuade anyone who's desperate, please don't use your outlet ground. But cold water is probably a good idea.
Comment?
Yes, please.
I'll go back to some advice, really good advice you gave me a couple of years back, Roy. KD2MLY, by the way. So with the grounding, I was grounding using the outlet, and that was an advice that that was given to me as well, and that was horrible, and you told me that would be horrible, and I was having problems with it, and so I immediately disconnected it. I couldn't reach the water pipe, but I was able to get close to the steam pipe, and that really worked out well. It got rid of a lot of noise, and it helped with, I know I was setting up for lightning grounding, but that really also helped with RF grounding, along with a new bus bar that I picked up and put, and a few other things that I followed through your advice. So that really worked. I'm thinking maybe the water pipe would have worked as well, but I wound up using the steam pipe, and that really worked. And as far as the hamstick antenna, I bought a two different style 80 meter hamstick antennas, and I barely get any type of receive on them, and I don't get out at all. So yeah, those 80 meter hamsticks didn't do so well, but the 10 meter and 20 meter hamsticks do decent. KD2MLY, back to net control.
Well, I'm glad the hot water pipe worked for you. I tell people that if they can get the cold, that's probably somewhat safer. There's always that problem in the back of your head. What happens if a lightning bolt runs down what you're using as a ground? Is it near a gas line, you know, which a lot of hot water steamers, what have you, you know, some are oil-based, but some are gas-based, and so there's always that question of a slightly increased risk that you don't get with a cold water pipe. But as you mentioned, there's nothing magic about hamsticks. Hamsticks are electronically tuned shortened verticals. So instead of a proper quarter wave, it's less than a quarter wave, and the that causes the antenna to have a high capacitive reactance that you don't want or need. So you neutralize it with an inductive reactance, and that adds a certain loss to the antenna. If it's a small inductive addition, because it's a relatively short antenna to begin with, then the losses are low. If you're making up for, you know, 20 feet of antenna line in the coil, then the losses in that loading coil are going to be rather excessive, and that's why you've noticed that. So I have nothing inherently against bottom-loaded shortened verticals. You see them all the time, especially for relatively high frequency, where they're just taking the edge off so that you don't bang into the garage door or swipe a tree as you're driving by. But when you're looking for kind of semi-ridiculous things like 80 meters operation, then you're expecting that loading coil to do magic, and we're not magicians. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for this, the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. And if you have any questions of a technical nature, any topics you want to toss around, or any comments you want to make, now's the time. We're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month, Wednesdays at 9 p.m. So if you have any other questions tonight, please give me your call sign and your name.
Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. Roy, I kind of have a question, not so much ham radio related, but more web page WordPress related.
Sure, what is it?
Right, I have been really new to it, playing with it here and there for about the last maybe 4 or 5 weeks. And I've just noticed that on my computer I can see everything fine and everything comes up fine on any PC that I go on. But somebody that I just was speaking to, it's not quite coming up on their tablet. And when I go to look on it on my Android phone, their tablet is an iPhone, iPad. When I go to my Android phone, the website comes up, but I don't see a photograph and I don't hear the background music that I have set up playing. So is there something, a plug-in or something I might be missing?
I think what's going on, could be wrong, but I think what's going on is there's two ways for some websites to present themselves. They often have what they call a mobile feature, that they query the browser. And if the browser is coming from a tablet or a phone, they do weird things. With the text, they restructure it in some way, so it might be a foible of the theme that you've selected. There might be a checkbox to disable it, checking whether it's mobile or not. So you might want to kind of touch base with the author of the theme that you're using. I assume you're using a theme because all of these that I've ever seen are theme based.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. I'm using a theme. I'm looking at somewhere it says Google Preview, and it says mobile result or desktop result, and mobile is already clicked. All right, it might be something that I'm just missing somewhere in here. Like I said, I'm very new to the software. I've been watching some videos, but I don't see anything that kind of looks like that in the videos.
Yeah, I mean, offhand, what I would do is disable the mobile view and see what it spits out for the Android. It might look better to you than what it thinks is appropriate for a mobile display.
All right, I'm going to try that. I'm going to do that actually right now and see if that works. I could always change it.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a problem with the theme itself, but it may simply be a choice that it's designed to make that breaks your design protocols.
William.
Yes, William.
What kind of a service provider have you got? Are you using WordPress.com, or did you do an installation on a different website, or what are you doing, to get that website to work?
I'm going through Mitch's 3 Alien web hosting, and he pretty much set this all up for me.
Okay, I'm not familiar with what that does. I ended up with a Bluehost website, and it has. You choose a theme, and then you're pretty much on your own to experiment and figure out how it works. It's really annoying. So I just was looking for some tips if you had any, but looks like we're on different paths.
You know, what's odd is, like, I'm on my phone right now, my Android, and everything that I wrote for it is here. You know, the whole script is here. Even the little the music bar that I put in, but it's not automatically playing like it does, like I've got it set up to automatically play. And it's not showing my main background image. So, I don't know. I guess I got to get in touch with Mitch and see what I'm doing wrong here.
Okay, very good. William, the problem is that if you pick a free theme, most likely there's no one on the other end who has any vested interest in helping you. You can try forums and such. For people who, and I know Mitch pays to use a theme for our Kings County Radio Club website. And, you know, there are places that you could knock on the door and say, this thing isn't working for me, what do I do? So that's sort of, unfortunately, the benefit of paying for a third-party theme.
So it goes to my old saying, the cheap man always buys twice. All right, so I've got to invest in a paid site. That is probably what's going on here. Yeah, I always try to go for the free software first. All right, so I guess I could consider this a good experiment, and once I get a little bit more versed in it, I guess I could boost myself up and see what I can do. All right, I guess that's pretty good. I want to say hello to everybody else that's out there. And, guys, if you're wondering what the website is, if you're on a regular PC and you want to get the full effect of the website, go to thefusionnet.org, thefusionnet.org, all one word.
Okay, very good, Joe. I'm looking forward to it growing. I visited it at one point. It was one page. Is it more than one page these days?
Yes, I've got the main page. Let's see. I got the main page. I've got the contact page done, and I've got the privacy page kind of done in a cute little way for now. We're gonna enhance it, but take a look. It's pretty cute.
Okay, very good. It's always fun to open up a new web page, new website. It's not quite that fun to keep maintaining things and updating things and moving things around and freshening things up and, God forbid, resetting things.
I am very gingerly moving around on this because I'm really not too familiar with it. So that's really why I haven't been on the radio. I've been doing a lot of reading, and experimenting. So I guess it's all new, man. I'm learning.
Yes, indeed. You know, I mean, it's a good thing to learn. Websites are alive and well and growing and changing. There's unfortunately way too many orphaned websites, although there have been some amateur radio operators who had extensive websites, and when they passed away, their children actually kept them alive by paying the bills and such and maintaining all the information that they had built up over more than a decade. So the web is a wonderful experience, and there's a whole bunch of nonsense around different places. You need a good BS meter, but as long as you have your BS meter well calibrated, the internet is a fascinating source of information.
William had a question. William, it's just the Fusion Net. thefusionnet.org.
On my phone, so I was just playing with it. So maybe I mistyped something.
The important thing is to remember the .org, because a lot of people just reflectively throw .com at everything.
And I think you just mentioned this phone as well. You're not going to get the full effect of it on your phone.
So far, it's really slow. And is it HTTP or HTTPS?
You're kidding me, right? Just put in thefusionnet.org and you'll have no problem. If it doesn't take you to there from there, I have no idea what to tell you.
I'll check it on the computer later. Thanks a lot, Joe. Out. Back to net control.
Okay, very good. I just pulled it up, and there's Nicola looking at me. I have a bobblehead in the shack of Nicola, him and Albert. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature that you would like to ask, topics you'd like to discuss, or comments you'd like to make before we call it a night, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be November 4th, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meeting begins at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you can communicate using Fusion Digital Technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly or using Fusion Digital Technology radio, or by a hotspot and other digital technology modes using our network gateways, such as our XLX server. We offer an audio stream of the FusionNet on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater. You can find that at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are always welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So it's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back here to do it all over again November 11th, and you're all welcome to join in as well. So thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Be safe, guys, until we speak again.